Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is community radio. Volunteers and listeners make this radio station happen. Thanks to our supporters, and here is a word about one of them. So, the Donalana Kitchen Show is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative connecting you to local farmers all year round, including organic meats and produce. More information at farmtofolk.com. We've got lots to talk about today on the show. We're going to be talking about GMOs, Herb of the Week. We've got some...
Herbs of the Week.
Herbs of the
Week. We've gone a little crazy with these herbs today.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about GMOs a little bit and consider Willy Wonka. Why not? Why not? We have a special guest. But first, Herb of the Week. I brought a show and tell into the show today, and I'll hold it up to the microphone so everybody can see it. It's called a garland chrysanthemum, or an edible chrysanthemum, and it is a green. It's a lovely green. It's easy to grow.
So this is not a wild plant?
No, no. I suppose it grows in the wild someplace, but not here. Plant it along with my cilantro.
And it's an annual, right?
It's an annual, as far as I know. The seeds are readily available if you look for garland chrysanthemum or edible chrysanthemum. It's known as shinginku in Japan. In Chinatown, it's used as choy soy green. And in England, it's known as crown daisies. It looks very daisy-like. It grows about...
Except that it's yellow on yellow.
White. 2 to 3 feet tall. The inside of them is
a
yellow. And the leaves, the flowers are edible for those that like edible flowers. But the leaves are pretty lovely. Garland chrysanthemum
has a
slightly mustardy flavor, kind of a floral mustardy flavor and a
crispy
tender.
No heat.
It's used in Korean, Cantonese, Japanese cuisines. It's a nice handy thing to have in your garden as you're going out there getting yourself a salad for supper. Just break off some and put it in your salad. Although in Asian cuisines, often used in stir fries, casserole dishes, flavors soups, stews, and hot pots. And in the Mediterranean, they tend to use it more as a green. And this amazing little plant has all kinds of antioxidant protection. It's used to encourage weight loss. It protects against cardiovascular problems, kidney stones, cellulite, bloating, and bone loss. It has many antioxidant benefits. It is extremely high in potassium, a lot higher than bananas, pound for pound. Not that you're going to eat a whole pound of it, but it's amazingly high in potassium. It protects against lung cancer. It's been used that way in Asian communities for a long time. It is botanically known as Chrysanthemum coronarium. So look for this chrysanthemum. It's a very nice thing to add to green anything. And it's a pretty thing.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, there you go.
And the leaves, you can see by looking at it that it's in the chrysanthemum family, but they're kind of smaller and frillier and more tender than the sort of plant that you think of, like, which for some reason, for me, chrysanthemum plants are funereal. I don't know why. But it's good, huh?
It is very good.
Yeah.
And it is pretty hardy, even during the hot weather. It eventually does bolt, and the leaves get a little bitter along about July. But plant them again, because they come up pretty well.
Oh, you can do two plantings
in
a season?
Yeah. They're hardy little things.
Okay, well, the plant I want to talk about this week is the black currant leaf. Not the berry, but the leaf. My neighbor, Ingrid Anderson, who is Swedish, is always introducing me to these things, especially around midsummer or midsommar, as they say. It's a big Swedish celebration.
Which is coming up next week.
Yeah, it's on the weekend, isn't it?
Summer solstice.
Summer solstice is like, I think of it as a, you know, it's a highlight, it's a big fun day, but it's also, it's the longest day of the year, which means that every day after that, the days get shorter. So it's kind of like I have mixed feelings about the day. It's like, oh, it's a sign that winter is coming again.
Well, you're much too morose. There's a lot of summer ahead of us yet.
Well, I know, but, you know, I love the long days. So, anyway, so Ingrid gave me this recipe. It's sort of an aquavit thing. She calls it a Fritolfsen's Svart. Vinbar's Uch Citron Snaps. How about that?
You just made that whole thing up. I know you did.
No, she's got it written out here. Right, we're going to give you the recipe. But basically, you take vodka and you, okay, she's got a pint of vodka, 1/2 cup of black currant leaves. She picks the little ones, the more tender ones.
And not the red currant leaves.
No, not red currants. It tastes different. Okay, so it's the black. And I really experimented because I have both plants in my yard. So I went out and I ate a red currant leaf and I ate a black currant leaf. And, you know, man, these Swedes know what they're doing. They've probably been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. So you take the 1/2 cup of black currant leaves, the tender young ones, no berries, though the berries will be here soon. But right now they're still green. And you put that into the vodka. And she did say she packs the 1/2 cup, not tightly, but not loosely. So, you know, we decided the more the merrier anyway. So don't stint on the black currant leaves. And then she puts, and this is optional, strips of the yellow only peel of the lemon. You can put that in or not. And a tiny bit of sugar. So for a pint of vodka, that's 1/2 cup of black currant leaves. And she says she puts a quarter of a lemon's of the peel only. Okay. And 1/2 teaspoon of sugar. So very, you know, this is not sweet. So she made it and we tasted it last night. And I'm telling you, it was out of this world.
Sounds like a nice way to say hello to the solstice.
Yes, and she served it with, of course, the traditional very salty herring. So you have this refreshingly herbaceous, very potent tonic of vodka, and then you have some of the salty herring, and it was a great combination. So we'll she says in the recipe, let it sit over a day, strain and cool before serving. But she had let this sit 5 or 6 days, and it had a beautiful light green color. And she and I concluded that we are going to make some more batches and let it sit even longer and see what happens. And then her husband, Walter, had a really good idea that maybe once the black currants are ripe, we should drop a few of that into the mix and see. Now, you know, black currants are not sweet. They're very tart, so it could be quite interesting.
Well, thank you.
So yum yum.
Two good herbs for the week. It's good.
Yep, we got some good herb information today.
Good. In the past, on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we've talked about a local organization called Ag Arts and the important role of the arts, words, music, images can play in telling a story. The arts can help us to understand our world, and using some of that idea, and the big topic of GMOs. We're going to talk about that today. We have a special guest.
Yes, our guest today is Adam Blake Wright. Welcome, Adam.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So Adam is he's the president of the ISU Ag Arts chapter, which I must say is the founding chapter.
Absolutely.
With Mary Swander and Fred Kirschman. He's also a recent Julia Child Foundation Food Writer Scholar. He has written for Edible Iowa, and he has an interesting dual degree that he's working on at ISU. He came as part of the writers and the creative writers in the environment MFA program, and while he was here, he, of course, got involved in agriculture. That's the very Iowa thing, and the SUS Ag program. So he is now staying longer to get a dual degree in sustainable ag and creative writing. Adam,
yeah.
tell us about a little bit about Ag Arts.
Absolutely. So Ag Arts was founded before I came here by Mary Swander and Fred Kirschman, and it was founded on the basis that that art can help us envision a better world. And we kind of wanted to work with people, not only in our local community, but across the state and the whole world, who are working in agriculture, but try to tell their stories through art, whether it's visual, whether it's literacy, whether it's painting, whether it's dance. And so here at ISU, we do two main things. We have a person come to speak with us earlier this year. It was Ava Chin, who was
on the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
she's lovely.
She gave a marvelous presentation at ISU.
Yeah, and she's an urban forager. Used to work for the New York Times, so she was a really great advocate for our event. And then we also have a annual Local Wonders potluck, and we do that usually in the spring towards the end of the second semester. And what we do is we have people apply to us, and they send us different projects related to ag and the arts. That's really the only parameters we put on there. Pitch their project ideas to the people in the audience, and then...
And these were mostly students. Some very clever ideas, actually.
And then we vote right there on the spot who gets the money.
But really, Adam is here to talk about and read one of his pieces of art explaining agriculture about a Monsanto event that he attended. We're not going to get in today. I'm going to try not to go on a rant because I'm sure you all know how I feel about genetically modified food, being the organic advocate that I am. We wanted to talk about a particular aspect of some, I would call it social politics that's happening right now. As you know, there have been a number of states across the country that have tried to implement the labeling of genetically modified food. Now, it's hard to understand why that would be controversial. It just means they want to let the consumer know if he's eating something that's been genetically modified or not. But there's been a lot of money spent in these campaigns. And, of course, it's actively financed by Monsanto and the Grocers Manufacturers of Association of America. And, I mean, millions have been spent on this issue because somehow they don't think people really care about what they're eating or need to know. I will say, and this has been true for years, that if you buy a product that is actually labeled with the USDA certification, the organic standards prohibit the use of genetically modified seeds. So if you really want to make sure that you're not eating genetically modified food, you do have the option of buying something with an organic label on it. However, that is the only thing. So part of the process that Monsanto has been, shall we say, spending a lot of money on and doing a big PR campaign is to try to influence the public to feel that their foods are not, quote, Frankenfoods, but are completely natural, totally healthy, and scientifically very well-founded. So in this latest effort, after all of these, after they have barely defeated all of the labeling things, except for Vermont, I think, and a few certain counties and things like that, they and the defeats were very narrow. Apparently, quite a lot of people really do want the food labeled. So, but they've begun two new public relations pushes this past year that I thought were very interesting as I read about them in the press. And I'm going to talk about the first one, and then we're going to turn it over to Adam because he's going to talk about the second one. The first one is that somehow Monsanto has made a major outreach to mainstream publications that besides like newspapers. And one of the evidence of this that I've seen recently was National Geographic, the good old trustworthy National Geographic of my childhood, had a display recently in the press. Chipotle, the restaurant, which we have one here in Ames, has made a public statement about less than a month ago that they were going to try to get all the GMOs out of their food. And it was presented as the request of the customers, and it was greeted by a lot of people very enthusiastically. It's about transparency in the food system and things like that. And Chipotle has been notably the most proactive food chain in the country to get more healthy and sustainable ingredients, and they've been very successful at it. I don't mind eating there because I know what I'm getting.
Yeah, I would say during the semester I probably eat at Chipotle once or twice a week. It's a good, you know, after class meal when you're rushed and stressed.
It's true.
And it's good
true.
Food.
You know, and sometimes when it's really, your generation has really, I go in there and I'm often the only person oldest person in there.
Well, somebody has to be done.
Well, that's okay. It's okay with me. But it's a pleasure, actually. So anyway, they made this major announcement, and then the press reception was very negative. I was shocked. And among the negative press was a quote from National Geographic claiming that Chipotle was being non-scientific about this. And this is a quote that you will hear through other outlets too, which lets you know that it's come from a press release or a press junket, as they call it, where they take certain writers and corporate sponsored. Okay, let's just put it that way. So what they said, that Chipotle was being unscientific or anti-science, that actually, get this, National Geographic claims that the science behind genetic modification is as sound and sure as the science behind global warming. Now, folks, I have to say, that's really hogwash. It really, really, really is blatantly not true, because the science behind global warming is about, 99% at this point. It's really substantial. The science behind genetic engineering is, and this is mainstream science, is maybe in the 80s, so that's not even anywhere near close. Plus, the science in the mainstream really, really omits a lot of science that's quite reliable, but has been dismissed through disinformation for a long time. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's come out recently that Monsanto actually has an office, a whole bureau, which is their job is to discredit scientists who have come up with research that is not favorable to genetically modified food. We all know at this point that our government has gone out of its way to support large industries in this country, like the oil industry or certainly the agricultural industry. And I find it really hard to trust a government that, since I've grown up now, condones torture, lies about a war, we didn't know that Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Anyway, it's hard to trust these entities that have a lot of money and a lot of power. So that was just one little thing that I've noticed, how they've really cornered the press lately. The other thing was Monsanto hired a whole new department. And Adam, what's the title of this called?
So we'll be talking a little bit about Vance Crowe, who he's only had his job for about a year. He was hired last June, and he is the director of millennial engagement.
Right. The director of millennial engagement. Yes. That is a whole new PR push on the part of Monsanto. And I watched this with a certain amount of amusement. And then I read that this young man, Vance, came to town. Adam, tell us about it.
Yeah. So I had the privilege of being one of the coordinators of the graduate program in sustainable agriculture's colloquium, which is a student-run class, and we change leaders every year. And so I was one of the people in charge of that. And so basically it's my responsibility to help invite people to campus. We have a variety of people, whether it's...
So once a week there's a lecture
Absolutely.
That everybody attends. I've even gone to some of them because you get really interesting speakers.
Yeah. We have writers, we have state officials, we have teachers, we have scientists. And so we were very lucky to have Vance Crowe join us. One of my co-patriots in that had heard an interview with him on NPR back in October. And so we were very excited because, again, he's the director of millennial engagement. Almost everyone in our program are, in their late 20s, early 30s. We're exactly the type of demographic.
And this young man is how old himself?
I don't know exactly. I would say he's probably in his early 30s. Mm-hmm, I don't think he's that much older than me.
So they've hired him to actually speak directly to your generation.
Yes, and Monsanto has this new pitch now that they are a sustainable agriculture company. And I think that our program's view of sustainability is quite different than Monsanto's. So we really invited him to have an open and honest dialogue about what that means. How can you be a large-scale international corporation and claim that you're sustainable? To a room of people who are much more interested in kind of local farming, organic farming, small-scale farming. And so, again, our ideas were really quite different. So we invited him to come speak, and it was probably the most popular colloquium of the semester. We had a lot of people from other areas of the campus come and speak to us. And it was an interesting experience, to say the least.
Well, tell us about, first say what the definition of sustainability is for the SUSAG program? Well, and I, you know, we have to put a little side note into this that a lot of the agricultural, good amount of money that supports Iowa State University's ag department comes from large corporations like Monsanto.
Monsanto is the single largest private donor to Iowa State.
Okay.
A good thing to remember.
Yes. Okay. So they sent their millennial coordinator in. Now, tell us kind of what the working, you know, sustainable is, I call it the slippery slope because it actually has no definition. One time I was talking to an Iowa farmer and he said, my definition of sustainability is that I can sustain my ability to farm. That was his definition of sustainability. So, and what is the sustainable ag program's definition of sustainability?
Well, as you said, there's really no hard definition. And I think even in our own program, which is an interdisciplinary program, so we have people from all walks of life across campus, philosophy, sociology, art, landscape architecture.
Writers,
exactly. So I think our definition of sustainability is different for everyone. I think for me, the best definition I've heard is replacing as much as you consume, which I think is a really interesting way to put it. And I would say that Monsanto's...
And as a writer... Words are important to you.
Absolutely. And I would say that Monsanto doesn't really have a definition of sustainability. I think it's just a word they're throwing out there because millennials recognize it, even if they don't know what it means.
It's a very popular word these days.
But I think their version of sustainability is, oh, you're worried about water quality? Well, we'll just set up a research center in Africa and say that we're doing things to help better, you know, increase our water quality, but That's where they leave it.
Could we fairly call this greenwashing?
Oh, absolutely. But they throw some money at something, they start a little corporation or research site, and they call it sustainability. But I found that really the hard facts are not quite there.
Well, tell us some of these hard facts that you learned from the millennial outreach coordinator.
Well, it was really a Q&A. He definitely kind of opened his presentation with a little bit of a spiel, but he did say, I know that I'm talking to a room full of graduate students, and you probably have a very clear idea of what Monsanto does. So he really kind of whittled that down and then opened it to a Q&A. It was certainly a respectful conversation, but I don't think anyone really got the answers to anything that they wanted to. So, for example, one of my peers was talking about some research facilities that Monsanto has in Mexico dealing with corn research. And we had both Vance and a scientist that he had brought along claim that they only have one research facility in Mexico. And I'll talk a little bit later about this tour that I went on at a Monsanto facility in Huxley, but they have a map on display, and there are over 300 research facilities across the world in 35 different countries, including multiple ones in Mexico. So that's an example of where we were told one thing that was directly countered by something else.
And the issue of Mexico and corn, it is a big deal because Mexico considers itself the sort of birthplace of corn.
Absolutely.
And they still, until, 20 years ago, were growing multiple varieties of corn, you know, that fit in and feeding themselves this corn. Each corn kind of fitted into the geographical niche where it was
as well as
grown.
A cultural niche as well.
Yes, absolutely. And then, of course, along came NAFTA. Mexico got flooded with a lot of, it was imported into Mexico, but it was exported from here, and it was genetically modified. And there was a huge outcry because the contamination, you know, corn pollinates largely through wind dispersal and can travel many, many miles. And so their heritage corns were being highly contaminated by this imported genetically modified variety, and it was and has been devastating to the peasant agriculture in Mexico. So having the Monsanto breeding facilities in Mexico is a big deal to the Mexicans.
Absolutely. And it's a big deal across the world because essentially what Monsanto is doing is they're taking a crop that's been around for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands for years. Mm-hmm. They're identifying what they call an interesting trait. That's a direct quote on a genetic level. And then they basically pull that out of the crop and then place it into another crop. And then with that, they can patent the crop and it is thus their intellectual property and they own it. Even if they've really done nothing to alter it, they've just essentially identified a gene and then claimed it as their own. So you have places like Mexico, many many countries in Africa, India, et cetera, that have had a crop for a long, long time, and then you have this large-scale corporation come in and they take it away from them and say, you no longer have the right to that. So
well, or you, what you have is
you have the right to buy the seed.
Yeah. You can't save your own seed. And then the possibility that their patented seed contaminates the genetic material that is your heritage, rightfully, and your heritage seeds are not patentable. So it's Vandana Shiva talked about that a lot. It's a sad situation.
We're listening to the Donalena Kitchen. This is KHOI 89.1. Good talk for the heart of Iowa. We'll have a little music break here. Back. This is the Donalena Kitchen. Donna and I are here in the kitchen with Adam Wright, a student from the Sustainable Ag group at ISU. He's going to talk about his response to GMOs and what recently went on at ISU with his organization. And he creatively came up with something called Willy Wonka's GMO Factory. Tell us about how you worked your way up to this.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned earlier, Vance Crowe came to speak with our colloquium, and the day after that, he invited as many students as he wished to come tour the Huxley Learning Facility, which is about 15 minutes outside of Ames. I was very excited because I thought I was really going to get to see some awesome stuff that Monsanto does. And there, unfortunately, there was only about four of us who attended this, so there wasn't quite as many people. But it was good in some ways because we had a very small group. And so we went to the facility, which obviously is kind of in the middle of nowhere, as these places tend to be, very nondescript from the outside. And then as soon as we walk in, you are met by this 50-foot jumbotron screen that is literally at a 45-degree angle between the wall and the ceiling. So it is looking at you, and it just says Monsanto. And, of course, we have these very stereotypical pastoral images like tractors going on in the fields.
These are all pictures on this big screen.
So farmers with their arms crossed looking at their corn, exactly. So I kind of had an ominous feeling as soon as I got in there. And we met Vance there, who was kind of our tour guide, and then he also had a team of three Monsanto scientists accompany us. So to start the tour,
Were the scientists wearing white coats?
They were wearing white shirts and belt buckles, which I mentioned.
Okay.
No. We were not in a lab. I will get to that in a minute, which I thought is what we were going. Because if you say you're a research site and a learning facility, you would think you would actually get to see some of the things that are going on. But they play this film from the Jumbotron. It's kind of a 10-minute corporate spiel about how we have a growing population. There's going to be 11 billion people by the end of the century. We have to find a way to feed them, and obviously Monsanto is the solution. So the end of this about 5-10 minute video says, "Welcome to the Huxley Learning Center and a new era of agriculture. The future of farming has arrived." So that's kind of Monsanto's view on themselves. And then after we saw this video, we took a turn around the corner, and I felt like I was in a museum. That's really the only way that I can explain this experience.
That's the learning center.
Yeah, so part museum gallery, part art exhibit, but also part theme park ride a little bit. If anybody, I'm from the South, I'm from North Carolina. If anybody's ever been to the World of Coke in Atlanta, that's how I would describe this experience.
Oh!
of kind of a corporate product turned into a spectacle. So I'm going to read a little excerpt from this piece that I wrote called Willy Wonka's GMO Factory. I think it's pretty self-explanatory once I get into this. But this was inspired by something that Vance said to us in colloquium. Vance has a very interesting background. You can Google him and learn a little bit more about him. But he said
What's Vance's last name?
Crow, with an E.
C-R-O-W-E. Okay.
Yes. And he said that one of the reasons he took the position at Monsanto, he said he admitted this was probably a company he never thought he would work for. But he said, who doesn't want to see inside Willy Wonka's chocolate factory? And I thought that was a very interesting analogy for him to make. That's one of my favorite books, and I think a lot of people love that book. There's obviously an amount of fun and absurdity with Willy Wonka, but if you really kind of analyze that piece, it's kind of dark, and Willy Wonka definitely does some things that maybe he shouldn't do, and
yes,
there
it's about
are
industrialization
kids,
of the food
yeah,
system.
There are kids who are tortured in his company. They get sucked up into tubes and turned into blueberries, so some pretty terrible things happen. So to compare your company to Willy Wonka is maybe not the most apt comparison.
Now, this is a piece that you've written that as soon as you publish it, we're going to let our listeners know where they can read the full piece.
Well, thank you. I appreciate this. So
well,
again,
it's a great piece.
So again, it's called Willy Wonka's GMO Factory. It's told from the third person, as Willy Wonka, the novel, is. So I refer to myself as Charlie to just kind of help this metaphor go along. So I'm going to pick up right after I've watched this kind of 10-minute film, and then I'm actually taken into the tour. So here we go. When the film finishes, the students follow Mr. Crow and his scientist, turn a corner, and face a long hallway lit by overhead lamps, each flicking on in succession, one after the other, as if signaling the entrance of some Broadway ingenue. Charlie hesitantly moves into this great grand space devoted to genetic engineering. Such mystique, such spectacle. The hall partitioned into several sections separated by column-like, barely there, ceiling-high walls. Each exhibit's educational focus clearly printed on the wall in white text. The first concerns seed science, creating higher yields through innovations in breeding, biotechnology, agronomics, and on-farm research. And that's a direct quote from what I saw on the wall. So when a scientist pushes another button, the smooth-voiced narrator promises that Monsanto's genetically modified Roundup-ready seeds protect against weeds, insects, and drought. He fails to mention that such genetically modified protection rarely functions without the help of chemical fertilizers and Roundup pesticides, all of which must be purchased at an additional cost to the farmer. According to research not covered in the film, 88% of all corn and 94% of all soy grown in the U.S. is genetically modified. Or in other words, 80% of all corn and 93% of all soy in the U.S. derives from Monsanto-owned traits, leaving little, if any, room for competition. Next, it's genetics, developing the highest-yielding seeds faster than ever. Here, our ragtag gaggle encounters a strange mechanical beast, the Monsanto-patented seed chipper. This invention allows scientists to scrape off seed slivers that can be simultaneously modified using the sliver and planted using the remaining seed, thus increasing research and observation efficiency. After another video explains these primary functions, Charlie, that's me, so lucky to be chosen first, is invited to experience the chipper for himself. He takes a seed from a plastic tray and inserts it into a small hole on the machine's plexiglass cover. A slender tube shoots downward, suctions up the seed, drops it above a rotating saw, removes the titular chip, and dispenses the seed into a slot for Charlie to grab. "Enjoy your chipped corn souvenir," the narrator says, as if this is simply one of those penny engraving machines someone might encounter at a museum, theme park, or historical landmark. Shortly thereafter, a scientist brings Charlie an entire collection of chip seeds, corn, of course, but also soy, cotton, melon, cucumber, wheat, all in one little plastic tray labeled with a Monsanto sticker and the code name TP0073 that can later be displayed amongst a growing collection of proprietary paraphernalia. Charlie and his classmates learn even more about the modifying of these chip seeds. Monsanto owns 300 research locations in 35 countries as a means to gather superior germoplasm from across the globe. A corresponding map reveals stations in the United States, South America, Africa, Europe, Southeast Asia, and Australia, while Russia and China appear Monsanto-less. If a so-called interesting trait is found in a seed, it is transferred to the nearby extraction lab in Ankeny, Iowa, where scientists locate, remove, and insert new genetic markers that are then patented as intellectual property. Using this strategy, Monsanto has built its own genetic library by generating at least one new product a year since 1996. How many patents do you actually have? Charlie asks. The scientists laugh and give no answer, only push along the onlookers to yet another exhibit showcasing the benefits of genetic modification. Agroeconomics, optimizing yield by understanding environmental variations. Why do you only focus on yield? A female student asks. Everywhere I look, all I see is yield. Yield this, yield that, it's all about yield. We are a seeds and traits company, a scientist said, hoisting up his belt buckle. But couldn't you look at other traits, the same student asks? Increased resistance to wind damage or improved root structure? I just don't know of any traits like that, another scientist says. The student, let's call her Veruca, shall we, closes her notebook and pushes back her short black hair. You haven't found any root-related traits to patent, even though you've marketed dozens of yield-related traits for the same purpose. That's right, a third scientist says. And I think I'll stop there.
That was Adam Wright reading from his piece called Willy Wonka's GMO Factory. So there really is. This is not fiction, although the title is a bit fantastic. There is a Huxley Research Center.
Absolutely. All is real.
There is a Ankeny splicing place where they splice things together.
And I have in my hand a little plexiglass box.
Yes, I brought my Monsanto souvenir.
Look at that, Lana. Isn't that a nifty little memento?
Yeah, so it's almost like you're at Disney World, you know. and to me, what is most troubling about this, you know, genetic modification is not a theme park ride. It is not something that we should be excited to go home and tell our moms about and be like, wow, look at this cool thing I just got on a field trip. But this is essentially what they're doing. And, you know, as a graduate student, I obviously kind of take a step back. But I think the purpose of this learning facility is really to do, like, outreach with maybe field trips for young children. And if I was a fourth grader, I could see how this would be really exciting. They have big TVs. They have souvenirs. They have something called a chipper that you get to test out. And so it makes genetic modification a really fun experience. But at the same time, it's a very tightly wound script that they have.
Well, also, it probably wouldn't be half so ominous if it wouldn't have something to do with patenting and owning our food system. We're talking about owning our food system here, not just modifying it, but they can own it.
Absolutely.
Goodness.
And I would say one of the other troubling things about this, so the experience was kind of set up in four different hallways, and you kind of walked around as if you were on a square. So you walk in, and you see this big ominous screen, and then you go into the next hallway, and each hallway has a different theme. And one of the hallways was about all the technology that Monsanto has developed for in-the-field tractor use, which I didn't even know. And one of the questions I asked them is, like, isn't
that – technology for in-the-field tractor use.
Yeah. Isn't that John Deere's purpose? And they said, oh, well, we develop, and then we sell to John Deere. And they sell to all the other tractor companies. But you go throughout this hall, and you actually get to see the technologies that they've made. And everything has either a trademark on it or a copyright symbol or a registered symbol. So it's very self-indulgent. And as I walked through there, I said, I'm aware of –
self-indulgent?
You know,
it's very profitable, Adam.
Absolutely. But I was aware of the fact that I was at a Monsanto research facility. They didn't have to tell me that at their learning facility they own and develop these things. So the idea of the fact that we own this and we take it very seriously, that this is our property, is very much in your face throughout this whole experience.
And that's something that probably the rest of us are supposed to get used to, that the food doesn't belong to the commons anymore. The food belongs to a corporation. This is not good. I don't think it's good.
But don't you think they have our best interest at heart here?
Well, I hope, you know, what you could tell from my piece is that the scientists were only there to push a button. And I'm sure that these are very smart men. They do have PhDs in their field. They are actual research scientists at
Monsanto.
And they're
extremely well paid.
But again, anytime we ask them a question, it was, oh, I don't know that, or that doesn't exist. And then they would move us on to the next exhibit and push a button on the wall, and then the narrator would tell us what Monsanto wanted us to hear.
This reminds me of something Bernie Sanders said the other day when he was saying, you know, these members of Congress that are kind of the climate deniers, he said it's not that they're stupid. You know, they know the science. It's that they're extremely well paid to not make these kinds of comments.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that, because I think my takeaway from this experience, beside the fact that it was essentially corporate propaganda, was this notion of, are they really drinking the Kool-Aid? You know, do these scientists really believe that what Monsanto is doing is a good thing and they're simply misguided? Or do they know that what Monsanto is doing is a really terrible thing that will have terrible impacts not only for our environment but also society as a whole, and they just do it to get their paycheck? And I ask myself that question a lot, mm-hmm. and I still can't answer it. You know, because again, when you ask someone with a PhD a pretty basic question about seed traits and they say, oh, that doesn't exist, you know, it makes me question, what are you really trying to tell me?
Oh, goodness.
I think that's an interesting question, and of course it would be individual by individual who's doing this. I mean, I had this odd experience. For a few years I was the president of the Iowa Organic Association. We have a booth at the state fair in the ag building. So, you know, you're out there with the organic ag sign plastered all over in big letters, and the public comes and goes around, and, you know, you get a lot of odd things. But one time I had a man in a white shirt, you know, dressed, visiting the fair, who came up to me and was actually very menacing and said, you guys don't believe this, do you? This is, you guys are really on the wrong side. This is, you know, I mean, he was menacing. He was scary. And you could see that it was affecting something very deeply held belief system that he had, that he was on the right side doing the right thing. And it was so important to him that our little booth at the fair was threatening. It was a very odd sensation I had.
Well, everyone has their own belief system in how we relate to the world, whether
right, it's belief
whether we
system.
Have, yeah, whether we have a garden or not, we all eat things. And we have a belief system. And it's time to decide, I think, how we are going to relate to the earth, because there's a whole lot of us and we make impacts on the earth. I want to take a little time to remind you that this is KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We've been talking to Adam Wright about his adventures in Willy Wonka's GMO factory. That's a wonderful literary piece that he wrote. And it was his reaction to a visitor named Vance Crowe. What are your takeaway thoughts about this experience?
Well, earlier we were talking kind of about what these scientists and corporate officials actually think. You know, are they trying to pull the wool over our eyes, or do they really believe it? And I think probably my takeaway from this whole experience, even though it was very disheartening, I think it opened my eyes in a lot of way, and I obviously got something that I'm very creatively satisfied with. But Vance told me at the end of his experience that this was probably the most important trip he's made within his tenure.
To visit the
Absolutely. Because this is his job. You know, he's supposed to travel the country and the world, reach out to millennials. I mean, he's essentially a PR person, and he does work at Monsanto.
For younger people.
But he's mainly, you know, what is the real world saying to Monsanto, and then how can we fix that? And he did tell me that, you know, more than half of the country right now does not even know who Monsanto is. They don't even know the word. And so he said, you know, do we...
Boy, I find that hard to
believe. I know, right? So he said, but we're very aware of the fact that there's a large amount of people who do not like us, and that voice is growing. So as a corporation, they're kind of trying to figure out, do we damage control. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Do we do damage control and try to quiet the voice that is only growing, or do we reach out to people and try to shape a positive image in their mind when they're already neutral? So I thought that was very interesting. And again, I'm not quite sure what Vance's personal beliefs are, but he did say that this was a very important experience for him, and we challenged him a lot on their definition of sustainability. Are their practices actually ethical? And so I think he had a lot to go back to and talk about. And so I hope that this experience will bring out some positive change, and hopefully, you know, if you're going to call yourself a sustainable ag company, you better be able to back it up. And at that point in time, they simply could not. And he basically said, I will never go to another university and not have a definition of sustainability.
This is the first time he'd run across that problem.
Absolutely.
Oh, for goodness sakes. If nothing else, the people at ISU at least asked a good question. Very good. Very good.
If you are seriously want to delve into some of these, you know, assertions that I've been baldly making here, there's a great book called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, one of several books about this issue. The subtitle is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systemically Deceived the Public. It's by Stephen Drucker. And it's a real eye-opener. I suggest reading the history of the development book. Altered Genes, Twisted Truth by Stephen M. Drucker.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're considering in local food. You may be wanting to cook up some of that local food yourself. Donna, what's a good way to do that this time of year?
Well, I'm thinking it's crock pot season. You know, you want something warm. And do you use a crock pot a lot, Lana?
Yes, I do. It is a fine ending for an old laying hen. I like a crock pot. I like a crock pot a lot. I use a crock pot all year. In the summer, I don't want to put that heat into the kitchen, so I just set the crock pot out on the porch. But
oh yeah.
But other than that, this time of year is the time to think about those slow cooked meals.
Well, the crock pots are useful for a lot of things, like making apple butter.
Oh, I have tried that. That is good.
I think it works dandy. You know, you just make your applesauce however you like, and then I just put it in the crock pot, and I kind of set the lid ajar and keep it on low and go to sleep. And the next morning I get up and I've got apple butter.
It really makes a difference.
It doesn't burn.
It doesn't burn. You don't just stand over the stove. If you had to do it over the stove to get it to the consistency of apple butter, you'd be there a long time.
Well, and you know, crock pots are, you can find them at garage sales. You can pick them up at secondhand stores. I think some considerations for crock pots is, Alana and I agree that the number one thing is to have a removable insert. Those old crock pots that don't kind of come apart so you can wash the insert, they're a little bit annoying.
They are, and I have an old one like that, and by now the metal outside that the ceramic inside is stuck to is kind of rusty and unsightly, and it's just not as nice as the one with the ceramic bowl on the inside,
right,
can
just
be lifted out of.
Which is also good for serving, too, sometimes if you want to do that. And crock pots are great for taking to potlucks. You can plug them in and it stays warm. Another consideration that I find is a glass lid is nice because the plastic ones end up looking funky after a while.
Oh, right, right.
I think so. And another thing that I like is the warm setting that you can do manually. Now, if you get really fancy, you know, they do have those programmable slow cookers, which I have never used. They do make the item a little bit more expensive. And, you know, since I'm not like a computer genius here, it's like, oh, dear, I have to put on my glasses and set this damn thing. So I just go for the manual, you know, slow, warm and medium and high.
Yes, on and off. I can handle that. That's good. Do you, as you are preparing your food to put in the cooker, do you just put in everything cold or do you, like, cook some things beforehand? Like, for instance, I find that I like to saute onions and maybe brown the meat before I put them in.
Yes, you can, definitely.
Otherwise, well, it's there, but it doesn't have the crispy edges. So,
well, of course you can, but you can also go the opposite way. I take, like, a pork roast or something straight out of the freezer, set it in the crock pot, put on the, you know, stock or just water and a bunch of bay leaves, and you just turn it on and forget about it, basically. So you can do like Lana does where you can cook in steps and add things when you want, or you can just put it in and forget about it.
Ah, good.
I also have a rice cooker, which I use this time of year quite a bit, actually. I found one that's stainless steel that doesn't have what's that stuff that we're not supposed to be it's not Teflon lined.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, but you do have to put a little bit of oil in it,
mm-hmm.
which is only reasonable. I have to say that I looked in the last Wheatsfield newsletter. I think it was online, and they had taken an article from Real Simple, 6 Brilliant Slow Cooker Breakfasts for Busy Mornings. And it's not that I've done any of these recipes, but it really opened up my eyes to other ways of, like, you could cook. One of the recipes is blueberry lemon poppy seed French toast casserole.
In a crock pot.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So I would recommend going on the Wheatsfield website to look at these things that they make it sound like you can, especially, you know, if you want to have a hot breakfast in your family, you put everything in at night, you go to bed, although they did say 6 or 7 hours. But if you have that warm setting and you want to sleep 8 hours, you could do that. But there were, like, breads. One of them suggested putting a loaf pan of bread in the slow cooker.
Oh, now that makes sense. I was wondering how it would not just kind of glue to the side. Okay, all right.
Anyway, that was a whole new concept for me is breakfast slow cookery. So take a look on the Wheatsfield website or else Google Real Simple.
Real Simple. That's a good start.
Yeah.
That's a good start. Yeah. Yes. Breakfast in a crock pot. Well, now that does require you. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with special guest Adam Wright. Music by Liz Donaldson and Alex Mitchell earlier, and marimba music to go out now. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison.
And thank you, Adam Blake Wright.
Thank you. It's been a blast. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Eat good food and enjoy life.